Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion on the topic, Human Trafficking in the Heartland. The members of the panel will include Stephen O'Mara, Assistant Attorney General and Human Trafficking Coordinator in the Nebraska State Attorney General's Office, Anna Brewer, former agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and currently training consultant for the Women's Fund of Omaha, and Alicia Weber, Human Trafficking Task Force Coordinator and Project Manager with the Salvation Army's Fight to End Trafficking, or SAFE-T, program. The moderator will be Megan Malik, Trafficking Response Coordinator with the Women's Fund of Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday morning, March 22, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Megan Malik.
One of the hardest things I think about trafficking is understanding, you know, the definition and what does it mean? And, you know, I always tell people this is not the movie Taken. It certainly, you know, can look like the movie Taken, but typically doesn't. So one of the things I like to have individuals talk about is, you know, what does force, fraud, or coercion look like? That's how we really define trafficking, that it has to have an element of force, fraud, and coercion. And force we can really see quite easily, but coercion and fraud are a little bit different. And Stephen spent 20 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office?
25 years.
Was the leading prosecutor on cases in this area, but has been working on this issue for 9 years. So I'm going to ask him to talk a little bit about what fraud looks like in trafficking cases and what coercion can look like.
To set the table, in the year 2000, there was a sea change with regard to how the United States and the rest of the world look at slavery and human trafficking being considered the modern slavery, human trafficking being divided into labor trafficking and sex trafficking. There's some other things we could talk about, but generally those things. And the federal government came up with the definition that Megan's referred to, the force, fraud, and coercion. The force generally being thought of as physical force or threats of physical force, although there's a case out of the Eighth Circuit that was actually done by the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force that Anna and I both worked on, which indicates that force is not necessarily limited to physical but could include some things that are not physical too. But the second definition is fraud. And again, borrowing from that particular case, it's the Bell case that came down in August of 2014 out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Any form of trickery or deceit is what fraud is. I think we see it in a couple of contexts, but generally we see it as either somehow you will be better off with me than you currently are, when in fact that's not true. Because in sex trafficking, it'd be the same thing in labor trafficking, but disproportionately the trafficker in sex trafficking, called the pimp, takes the money or whatever financial benefit there is from the trafficking. So it's false to tell the person that you'll be better off, because in fact you aren't. You make money for me, not for you. The second major fraud that we see is I love you, and that can be stated in any of a number of ways. It can be we'll have children together. In the end, it will just be you and me. Different ways that this can be exemplified. But again, the trafficker doesn't mean it. All traffickers tend to appeal to kind of a short-form Maslow's hierarchy of need in their victims. They tend to appeal to love, fear, and a feeling of personal well-being. And actually, this was part of the closing argument in the trial of the Bell case. So that fraud can be anything, again, that's deceitful or trickery. In one of the cases that we did, a young woman was in a homeless shelter in South Omaha, and she was tricked out of the homeless shelter by a supposed friend and then kidnapped into sex trafficking, being taken from Omaha to a motel in Council Bluffs. That tricking her out of the homeless shelter with the purpose of kidnapping her into sex trafficking in and of itself would have constituted fraud, whereas the kidnapping would have been force. Coercion is maybe the biggest change that occurred in the law, and although the Nebraska law or the Iowa law, the state laws, are not specifically based on this, they mirror the federal law, so it's useful even in understanding what human trafficking means under Nebraska or Iowa law. The coercion, we aren't going to go through the full legal definition because it's multi-steps, but what it boils down to, again, is the idea that it can be anything physical or non-physical. It can be threats against your reputation, threats based on your financial condition. It's an extremely broad scope of things. And really what we've ended up is now we don't just ask what was done against the will of the victim to compel them, but did the victim really have a full understanding and agreement to enter into prostitution or forced labor? And so it's a shift from a compulsive look at this to a look at, was this with the full consent of the victim? And in particular, we look at a number of categories of things, and this is based on the work we've done as the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force with these cases. We look at anyone under 18 years of age. That is per se coercive. That is against their will. There is no thing as a minor prostitute, period. Anyone under 18 cannot legally consent to do this in sex trafficking. Then we also look, particularly with minors, but also what happened to people when they were minors in terms of whether or not there was an abusive environment, particularly sex abuse, or there was other really significant dysfunctional history, either with regard to the family or the individual. Then we look at mental health or developmental disability is another major category where we have seen victimization. Addiction, particularly chemical substance abuse. Poverty, particularly homelessness and educational deprivation. And other isolating factors generally, such as being put in either a true correctional facility or community corrections as an adult or a minor can put people into a high-risk category for being victimized. And also other isolating factors such as language, cultural disparities such as honor or debt bondage or fear of authorities, particularly with regard to people from other countries, but not necessarily limited to that. And then we always look to see who holds and controls means of communication, who holds and controls means of identification. Both of those things are what allow us our mobility and our ability to be social within the country, within this country. And so the more we see deprivation of communication or deprivation of means of control of identification, the more we look at the person as being a victim. So ultimately, we look not only at the actions and intent of the human trafficker, but we also look very much and from the beginning at the victimization of the individual we believe has been victimized, and particularly if there are categorical vulnerabilities that we have experienced. And those all feed back into coercion and fraud.
Thank you. One of the things we also talk about with coercion sometimes, because I think it's hard for us to see that it is oftentimes somebody close to the individual that they know. So a parent can traffic their child, a boyfriend can traffic his girlfriend, and we oftentimes see that. And it often looks like a sexual predator would through a grooming process. And so that's something that is really important to remember, because the coercion doesn't look as in your face, and people may say, well, it looks like this individual is choosing to do this, and oftentimes that is not the case.
Megan, maybe just also mention, too, that very much disproportionately the victimization involves women and girls, but also there are definitely males that are victimized at a lower percentage, but perhaps that's partly because we have not really looked into that victimization as much as we have otherwise. But it's important to indicate that that also exists.
Yeah, there's certainly a number of unknowns nationally with numbers, and so we're all really learning as we go, trying to figure out, you know, where this is at, how do we stop this, are we looking for the right thing. I want Anna, just some context. Anna started the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force about 8 years ago, is that?
2010.
2010. 6 years ago. And has worked the cases in the area, had experience before that with the FBI. And so I want her to talk about, you know, what are some red flags and indicators of trafficking? What can it look like that we might not be thinking of?
Well, I think visually we are starting to notice that pimps or traffickers are starting to brand their commodity. And so a pimp is going to have a typical or a particular moniker that indicates that that person, that woman or girl or boy, belongs to that pimp. Oftentimes, for some reason, it's the letter P, so it'll be P Daddy or, you know, P something. Oftentimes, we see the word MAC, M-A-C. It stands for Master of the Art of Communication. And basically what that means is the pimp thinks that they have the ability, through manipulation of communication and talking to girls, to encourage them to join him and work for his organization or his stable, which is what a group of women that work for a pimp is called, a stable. So that's one indicator, is our tattoos. But oftentimes when we're speaking and presenting, we speak to different groups. So we might be speaking to a hotel or a motel. And in that situation, we would be asking the hotel to be on the lookout for maybe a lot of traffic in and out of a hotel room, maybe some unrelated people sharing a hotel room and paying in cash, using the prepaid credit cards. I think most of us probably have a bank card or a credit card that's, you know, you get a bill every month. Pimps tend to use prepaid credit cards that they can purchase at the checkout counters at Target or Walmart, paying in cash. Little luggage for a long trip. So if the person with whom you are speaking says, oh yeah, we've been traveling for a month, but they only have a weekend bag, that's pretty significant. If a police officer does a car stop and separates the people in the car, and nobody really knows anybody else's name in the car, they only know them by nicknames, or they're all from different cities, they don't know where they're coming from, they don't know where they're going, everybody has a different story. Pimps do not let those who they traffic make eye contact. They don't like the girls to make contact with the other pimps. And so oftentimes you'll have a person talking to you and they're just looking down like this, and they just won't make eye contact with you. Another example that we see, and that we trained TSA employees at the airport and or people that work in transportation industry, is, for example, when I travel with my husband, as much as I want him to open the door and let me walk in first or pull out a chair for me, I carry my wallet, I carry my purse, I have my ID in my possession. I have my cell phone in my possession. But oftentimes we'll see that these people use controlling their identification and or controlling their method of communication as a way of controlling their commodity or the person that they're selling.
You know, one of the things that the task force, and we're going to talk more about the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force, but one of the things that we've been working hard on is screening, and how can we provide not only all service providers, but how can we provide law enforcement, anybody who could potentially interact with somebody who may be being commercially sexually exploited or labor trafficked, how can they identify them? And so I'm going to let everybody maybe take a little bit of time to talk about what screening questions and what tools could be instituted for us to better recognize this and what we're working on.
I guess a lot of the things that I do in the jail, I'm trained as a therapist, so I don't screen necessarily, I more assess. So a lot of what I try to do is sit down and really talk to them about their... Sit down and talk to them a little bit more about their story, I definitely want to know about relationships between the person who's possibly controlling them and themselves, try to find out if there is any sort of element of force, fraud, or coercion in that. A lot of things will be red flags as far as I know, usually, typically their income level, but they're dressed really well or they have designer brand clothing, things like that. So things that aren't consistent with the information that you have can definitely be red flags as well.
In law enforcement, in the work that the Nebraska Task Force has done, and I'll just point out the Nebraska Task Force officially started October 20th of 2015, so we haven't been doing this a long time, but based on experience that the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force has had and research, we've kind of divided this into pre-screening and screening. And so pre-screening is what a road deputy or a street officer would really look at if they encountered a situation, for example, where there was a traffic stop and curious circumstances, or based on one of the examples Anna gave, if they answered a call to a hotel or motel and found curious circumstances, what is that person who is not expertly trained with regard to human trafficking, what should they look for? And we've kind of tried to narrow that down and have found this to be a hard job to a small set of initial questions and then actually a series of observations. And maybe if Anna doesn't mind, she could talk about the observations some because she's really good at that. But on the questions, we'll just note that there's a couple of things that even a field officer should look at. And then following that up, if there's an articulable and reasonable suspicion or probable cause that, in fact, this is a situation of human trafficking, then a more expert officer would follow that with a greater initial assessment, a screening to actually determine if this is human trafficking or not, to move forward under constitutional guarantees and take more action. So a couple of the things that we would definitely want to know about is things like, does the person know where they are? One of the tells is that an individual doesn't know, for example, what city they're in, but they're from a different location. Much of human trafficking is carried out, sex trafficking in particular, is carried out in circuits where the bad guys actually ride around part of the country or a region and victimize people, deliver their services. So finding out, does the person know where they are? Finding out what is the relationship between the person who is potentially a victim and the person who is potentially a trafficker. And that presupposes that you have seen enough that you must actually separate the potential victim from the potential trafficker. And I don't mean on different sides of the same automobile. I mean actually have separated them. And then finally, questions, and again, remember, this is just pre-screening. These are just those few questions you try to ask up front. Has the person, by some language of force, fraud, or coercion, has the person been caused to engage in sex acts, particularly for money, that the person would not otherwise have engaged in or did not feel comfortable engaging in? Or the same thing with regard to labor or services, which would be labor trafficking. And then finally, does the person feel safe? Does the person need help at this point in time? And we don't really have a lot of time to go into this, but there's really some trauma-informed considerations that even law enforcement needs to be aware of, even in the field, to be able to effectively do this to better identify and help victims. This is something we're trying to concentrate on going forward. But that's kind of just a short overview.
And I forgot to say this caveat earlier, but we We use the term oftentimes victim and survivor interchangeably, and we know that each person's story is different, and how each person wants to be addressed is their own decision to make. And so, but oftentimes when the police are talking about investigations or their different laws, they often talk about victim and victimization. So I just really like to put that out there and honor that we know that everybody who has been commercially sexually exploited is a survivor.
And a little bit about observation. So I always try and put myself in your shoes and think, you know, how can you guys apply what we're telling you to your own lives, right? You're not an FBI agent. You're not coming into contact with victims, or you don't think you are on a regular basis like I was. So a couple examples. One example actually has, there's a girl that has a tattoo on the inside of her lip. Well, if you were a dentist, and I've had a dentist come up to me and say, you know, I'm a dentist and I don't pay for sex and I'm not engaging in human trafficking, how could I ever help? How can I ever affect change or make a difference? And in one of our cases that we investigated that stemmed out of South Omaha, where a 13 and a 15-year-old girl were recruited and engaged in commercial sex acts against their will, the pimp punched one of the girls in the mouth and knocked her tooth out. And because, you know, aesthetically, we are a community of, you know, always looking good and looking our best, the pimp felt required or obliged to take her to a dentist. And he took her to a dentist. And had the dentist asked some maybe probing questions like, what happened? Are you safe? You know, that happens to me when I go to the doctor now for my well woman check every year. They ask me, are you safe at home? And I kind of giggle because my husband's an FBI agent and I was also. So I'm like, yeah, of course I'm safe. Why are you asking me? But I love that they do that. Another example would be if you worked at McDonald's or a fast food restaurant, oftentimes the girls or the victims are not allowed to eat until they have earned enough money and they earned the privilege to eat. And so if you're working at a fast food restaurant or a restaurant for, you know, any restaurant for that matter, and the pimp is deciding what she's allowed to eat or how much she's allowed to eat, that's a clue. If you work in a clothing store or a Target or a Walmart and you see young girls that should probably be in school on a Monday at 10 o'clock in the morning and they're in the lingerie section purchasing somewhat inappropriate undergarments, again, that's a clue. So you might just be an ordinary citizen going about your ordinary day and you see things like that. Then when you approach them or you're, you know, kind of, can I help you? You know, if you were in Target in the clothing section and you see that she has these inappropriate tattoos, you hear some of the language that they use to communicate with each other. The prostitution world has its own language. So prostitution is referred to as the game. Pimps are referred to as daddy. The girls know each other as wife, wifey, or wife-in-law. And the girls that the pimp has working for him are usually known as the stable. So if you heard, hey, daddy, where's wifey? And she's, you know, young and she's buying lingerie in, you know, Walmart or Target at 10 o'clock on a Monday and she should be in school. You know, again, not saying that you're definitely a victim of human trafficking, but more likely than not, these are some of the indicators. So these are some of the observations that people that are not in law enforcement or maybe not in the healthcare industry might come across.
And maybe to really stress the idea that none of the things we're talking about individually or even all together conclusively prove that a person is a victim of human trafficking or that a person is a trafficker. But they are signs that people in the community, particularly people who are in positions where they are likely to encounter victims, should be looking for. And to emphasize, we probably have a list of 20 or 30 things that people should just make routine observations about. So, for example, a law enforcement officer at a traffic stop, things in the vehicle, things about the people. But if you take some of the things that Anna talked about and you combine those with particularly tattoos, avoidance of eye contact, who controls the means of communication, who controls the identification, and a few other really key things, then you almost certainly have a situation where you should move it to the next step of inquiry, even if that means taking control of the person who is the potential victim. And again, this is something we're going to be providing specialized training on going forward in Nebraska.
And I know you're probably wondering, well, if I see that, what do I do? And what do I say? And, you know, should I intervene? And first know that your safety is the most important thing. And so if you are at a Target or are at a hotel, the best thing to do is go to a supervisor in that place or in the hotel, but that you can always call the human trafficking hotline. That is always an option. And it's kind of, we like to talk about the human trafficking hotline like we do the child abuse hotline. If you call and give a tip, each time you give a tip, they're going to document that information, and that information does get to the right people. We are in the process of strengthening that system so that when tips come through to Nebraska from that hotline, we have good response mechanisms in place. But it's just important that you have that option. If you believe it is an emergency, you can always call 911 and never hesitate to do that. I am reminded, and I often share this story that I had read in the paper about a 14-year-old girl who was in a hotel room for 3 days. Her pimp dropped her off. She was there. The pimp just set up several dates for her. Many buyers came and purchased her. And finally, when the cops recovered her, they said, well, why didn't you say anything? You were there by yourself for 3 days. You know, you could have had. And she said, I was there for 3 days and not one person looked at me, not one person made eye contact with me, and not one person said something. And it was just, you know, shocking. And you think we've oftentimes become a society where we just look the other way and we've got so much going on in our own lives. So it's just a really good reminder that if something feels off, you know, to go with your gut and make that call, because it's the police's job to investigate those situations.
If you call 911, in particular, if you think this is a situation that involves child abuse or domestic violence or human trafficking, you should particularly make a point with the dispatcher that this involves a situation where you have seen a person be at risk personally, and even request or use the words personal welfare check in addition to reporting that it is a crime. Officers have to react a different way if personal welfare is at issue. They may do things that they would not necessarily do if it is just a 911 crime call. So that's something to keep in mind if any of those circumstances are involved.
I'm going to switch gears just a little bit to what we have seen that, you know, victims and survivors are really in need of and how we can best provide services to them. One of the things that is unfortunate is that there are really no existing best practices out there nationally for model programs. This is a newer issue where service providers are now taking on, and so everybody's really trying to figure out what is working and what is not working. The Women's Fund, in collaboration with the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force, did a needs assessment survey that you can find on our website, and I put the information on there that talks a little bit about what service providers believe the highest needs are. We also will be releasing, hopefully in this next month, a survivor voice report. We just felt as a task force that it was really important that we are hearing from the individuals who have been victimized and to hear from them themselves of what those highest needs are. But we are really thrilled to have Alicia and Salvation Army on our team. The Salvation Army, collaboration with the Attorney General's office, received a large federal grant this year, and it is a really big deal for Nebraska. We are the only two states now. We are the one of two states that got that grant as a statewide effort. So it's a very big deal. The Attorney General's role is really to set up the task force, and Salvation Army is to provide service provision. So Alicia is leading that charge for us and is a great clinician, has a lot of experience working at the Salvation Army for the last several years with survivors. So I want, Alicia, if you can talk a little bit about some of the greatest needs that you see that survivors have had.
So my experience actually comes from the Wellspring program, which is actually with the Salvation Army as well. I worked as a case manager and therapist there for 3 years before I moved into this position. And we're working to build the safety program, which offers intensive case management to survivors across the state of Nebraska. in my experience and in the Salvation Army's experience, housing is usually a number one priority, especially when people are being pulled out of these situations by law enforcement or they're being recovered. Safety and housing is always an issue. Domestic violence shelters do work sometimes, but it's still not a great fit, and it's only a 30-day program. What we've found is we have to be available long-term with a consistent case manager, a consistent clinician. Otherwise, we do lose these individuals fairly quickly because of the trauma that they've been through and their inability to trust people to help them. So shelter and housing, absolutely. They also need a source of income. A lot of the individuals have become addicted to fast money, even though they don't necessarily see the benefits of that. And they've also learned to gauge their self-worth by how much money they can bring in. So education and job training is a huge need for them as well. Admittedly, that is a little farther down the line sometimes for people because of the trauma, but helping them reintegrate and find some sort of income to support themselves as fast as possible helps keep them out of that lifestyle. Absolutely, mental health services, both crisis intervention, but then also long-term services, especially for post-traumatic stress disorder, any other severe persistent mental illness that they may have had before they came in or has developed as a result of their traumatic experiences. Also, substance abuse treatment. For a lot of these individuals, they do end up having some sort of substance abuse issue, either as a means to control them while they're being trafficked or as a way to cope with the trauma that they've experienced. A few other things that I know that we're just required to do under the grants, we have to do job skills, medical and dental services, legal, any immigration services, interpretation, things like that. They're all also very important things that service providers need to be able to provide or find a way to get those things provided for them.
And I think to Alicia's point that this is long term, we can't stress that enough. Oftentimes, you know, Alicia will talk about seeing individuals go back into the life and as a service provider having to have an open door, you know, policy so that when that individual is ready and that it's not an element where the service provision becomes forced or coerced, that it has to really be incremental and allowed. So this is definitely different than a lot of other service provision. Again, we're still really learning about what is going to be most effective and how we're going to do this. And what we know and what the task force is committed to is it's going to take an entire team. It's going to take doctors and dentists and mental health professionals and caseworkers and individuals to teach life skills to really do this, but to do this as a team and not an overwhelming manner. And sometimes for us, I've spent my life in service provision, and so that's sometimes a different way to do it, to deliver services. So, but the team is really committed to really delivering services in a different way than have been delivered before. So to that end, Alicia, will you talk just a little bit about, you know, because we don't have a lot of services in Nebraska, and that came through very clearly in our needs assessment we did, 84% of respondents, which include law enforcement and service providers and mental health professionals and educators, said we are not doing a good job. We are not serving these individuals like we should. So can you talk a little bit about how you've gotten creative in some of the service provision that you've done and what you've seen really work?
Yeah, I think a lot of it really does boil it down to collaboration. Like you said, it's difficult to piecemeal together some sort of treatment plan for these individuals because they don't fit neatly into anybody's box. HUD guidelines for homelessness, sometimes we have to get creative with documenting that homelessness. It can be pretty difficult to prove true homelessness to get into housing programs. So sometimes we have to get creative with those eligibility requirements and then just really go to bat and advocate once that application is turned in. There are some flex funds out there that are sometimes easy to access, sometimes not, just depending. But flex funds are very, very helpful to just kind of meet whatever need that your client has. The behavioral health regions, if there's any sort of mental health diagnosis, they do offer flexible funding for things like furniture or treatment, intensive case management. They also offer that as well. So there are some resources that route, since we do tend to work a lot with people who have mental health diagnoses as a result or before the trafficking incident occurred. And also churches. Churches are really a wealth of information. They're a wealth of support. And also sometimes they have flexible funding as well. Pantries aren't really necessarily creative, but it's definitely a way to free up any funds that your client or your survivor may have to access food so that they can use that money for something else, a bigger need.
And I think one of the things that Alicia really makes sure that no matter who she's working with, and, you know, when she trains on this, you can see the difference if you're doing this type of service version than others, and that's that trauma-informed care. And it's not just giving it lip service, but it's really using a trauma-informed care model and making sure that those other service providers that are working with the survivor are also using that model is really critical.
I will say, too, Wellspring has a support group, and they're actually a wealth of knowledge as well. They've been through most of the systems in Nebraska, the housing system, everything else, really. And so they can describe services a lot better than I can as somebody who's been through those services. And they also sometimes know more than I do about how to access services. So if you can build some sort of peer support group or some sort of supportive group of people who have been through this, it's also very, very helpful in accessing services and finding different ways to get things done.
Thank you. I am going to have Stephen talk a little bit about the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force plan. We talked about the internet is the new track. So a lot of this is occurring online on Backpage.com. We've been trying, one of the hardest things to figure out is what is the prevalence. So just a little bit of a graph for you to see what does this look like in the Omaha area? How many postings do we have? And what we have found, we've got a initiative at Creighton University doing some research for us. And what we have found is that there has been 959 unique individuals posted in the, since November. We've been scraping the data since November. And what is probably the most concerning is that 47% of those individuals posted have an age of 24 or younger. And you can't legally post on Backpage anything younger than 18. So that is very concerning to us, because what we believe is that there are a lot of young individuals likely being exploited on Backpage, which is why the U.S. Congress is holding them in contempt at the moment. The other thing that has been concerning that we've seen is that it looks like the average stable size is about 2.6, meaning that individuals, there's over two individuals connected to the same phone number, which often leads us to believe that there is a trafficker involved, which then would lead us to believe that these individuals are being exploited. So that's a huge concern. So, Stephen, if you'll just talk a little bit about the task force, what some of the goals of the task force are and where we're going, that would be great.
To preface that, if you heard the numbers since last November, which you should find shocking, 900-plus individual victims, I remind you that even though this is the lion's share of the suspected sex trafficking in Omaha, this is not the only model of how people are being trafficked in Omaha. There are people who are trafficked who do not have a relationship with the internet. So the numbers you hear are hearing, they may be 20% or more short of the actual numbers of people that are being trafficked in and about Omaha itself. So that's another thing to keep in mind when we look at these. The Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force, as I said, was established by the Attorney General on October 20th of 2015, so it really hasn't been formally in existence yet for 6 months, but we did do some prep work. And what we have done is brought together a group of people, multidisciplinary, to look at this issue. And that group continues to expand. And the focuses of what we are trying to do on the task force to continue to expand. We need to integrate, to bring together those spheres of influence with regard to the human trafficking problem. And those three spheres, for the most part, involve law enforcement, service providers, and community partners. And you've heard something about law enforcement, and you've heard something about service providers, realizing that there's a lot of work to do in both of those spheres. But we've also found that if we want to be successful with regard to addressing human trafficking, we also have to integrate with that community partners. And I will tell you that the community partners that we are concentrating on, I mean, ultimately we would like everyone, but we're concentrating on it kind of in a priority order, healthcare professions and industry. The reason for that is there's a study out from the Beasley Institute of the Chicago Loyola School of Law. It's one of the more authoritative studies with regard to the survivors of sex trafficking. And that tells us that about 88% of the survivors of sex trafficking in a national study encountered a healthcare professional during the period of their trafficking. And yet there is almost no screening in the healthcare industry to identify potential victims of human trafficking or circumstances of human trafficking. So this is something we're working on in earnest in Nebraska as we try to move forward. The second group is the hospitality industry. Mostly think hotels and motels, but it could also include restaurants and some other things. And so, for example, I'll just indicate, we have a lot of major events that are held in Omaha, and there are sponsors for those, and there's a visitor's center, and there's other people in the community that deal with the things that we should be very proud of that we have in Omaha. And I'll just say it. For example, the Berkshire Hathaway event, the College World Series. Last year we had what Des Moines had this year, the NCAA men's basketball first round, the swim trials, the equestrian competitions. We really have in Omaha, for the population, really significant major events. Major events draw sex trafficking. The events aren't the sex trafficking. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not suggesting anybody in those events is complicit, but they draw people to town who have money to spend, and a lot of them spend it on vices, including prostitution, which is the bedspring of sex trafficking. So that's the hotel-motel industry, because even though some people stay in bed and breakfast or rent an apartment or whatever, most people carry this out in hotels or motels. The statistic is somewhere ahead of 70% of sex trafficking is probably carried out in hotels and motels. Then we also look at other industries such as transportation, gaming in the sense of casinos and that type of gaming, and other things in the community that we look at. And finally, for people, really important to try to integrate into this on the positive side, although candidly it will reach some people on the negative side, is faith communities. And so that's a national emphasis to try to reach those. So we have a list of about 7 or 8 of these community partners. Education is another main one because of the age group that are often victimized. The Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force has encountered about 250 primary and secondary victims from January of 2010 to January of 2015. All of those female, which is not to say that there are not some male victims, because actually there were a couple cases that were ancillary to that work that had male victims. But in fact, they ranged in age from 12 years old to 40 years old. The average was about 17 to 22 years old, which is alarming when you consider the statistic Megan told you about all the ads for individuals under 24. And what's been happening in the last year and a half to 2 years is that there have been more incidents of human trafficking discovered by the task force, and the age has been dropping, the age of the victims, to where there are many more victims in the 14 to 17-year age range than we were finding before. National FBI statistics say that could be around 54% of the victimization could be actually minors. So the point is, we don't really know now, but we're finding out. So all of those community partners are really important, and we are working very hard to bring them together to work. And we're doing that up front. We've seen the efforts in some neighboring states where they jumped into this and didn't try to forge these partnerships. And candidly, it really doesn't work real well. It's really having problems getting this working relationship. So this is where we began. And I'll tell you that this plan, it's about a 70-page document. It's available on a drop-down menu on the website of the Nebraska Attorney General's office. It has an executive summary. It has the principles that particularly the law enforcement and services people working on this agreed to together that would be the guiding principles for forming this task force. It has a narrative explanation of why we are doing many of the things we are trying to do with the task force. And then it has the plan itself, both the administrative and operational components for making this work across the entire state of Nebraska. I'll just be real quick with 3 points then. There are 3 main goals of the task force. The first one is to help victims and survivors. And we do use both of those terms because we don't want any confusion on that. Law enforcement does tend to look at the acute phase of involvement of victimization. Law enforcement tends to encounter people when they are actually being victimized, and so we call them victims. But in fact, we looked at that as a broader category with regard to survivors, which is really more in vogue, particularly with how services would identify these individuals. They're the same people. They're victimized. Thankfully, most of them actually do become survivors, although all of them do not. There is a death rate associated with human trafficking. So the first thing is to help victims and survivors. That's why under the grant, Alicia's a part of this. That's why Megan is doing a lot of what she's doing with regard to this, and why many of the partners in this process, in fact, are from the services community. The second main goal is to stop traffickers, and we have to do that through investigation and prosecution. And so we are looking at things like recommendations to up the penalties. The Nebraska penalties are way behind the federal penalties. The federal penalties are basically 10 years or 15 years minimum mandatory to life imprisonment. The Nebraska penalties range from 0 to 50 years, but that's not real time. It's about half of that is what we're really talking about. And so if we're going to make a change, we have to treat traffickers as traffickers. This is a violation of the Constitution. This is a violation of very serious felony statutes. This is, as the task force has declared it to be, an abomination against humankind. This is slavery in whatever form it is. This is a very serious situation. We need the legislature to understand that and act accordingly. And then finally, we really emphasize reducing the market. This is all market-driven. as bad as it is, the traffickers treat their fellow human beings the way they do for money, pure and simple. No buyers, no trafficking. So we are dedicated to not only going after the people that are called traffickers, but also the people that buy the commercial sex acts with regard to sex trafficking, and then ultimately with regard to labor trafficking, to where there is culpability to the people that buy the services or goods that are produced by people in circumstances of human trafficking. There is a case in the Eighth Circuit, federally again, which says that in certain circumstances, buyers can actually be treated as traffickers. That means they can be charged, convicted, and sentenced in federal court to 10 or 15 years to life imprisonment. But that primarily deals only with minors until some more prosecutors actually get aggressive and try to expand that interpretation of the law. But part of what we're really going after, that's to reduce the demand. We also want to reduce supply, and it's kind of a crass way of looking at this, but we told you before the categorical vulnerabilities that exist out there. And so if we as the people of Omaha, the people of Nebraska, want to reduce human trafficking, one of the things that we should look at is doing a lot better job than we do with regard to helping the people that suffer from the categorical vulnerabilities. And that includes child abuse and sexual exploitation and neglect. That includes mental health and developmental disability. That includes all forms of addiction, emphasizing chemical substance abuse. That includes poverty, particularly homelessness and educational deprivation. It includes any and all of those categorical vulnerabilities that we talked about. So whenever you're looking at a market equation, you look at supply and demand. But ultimately, what this comes down to is the traffickers. And that means we have to change the risk-benefit analysis that human traffickers do. The Urban Institute report that came out in March of 2014 makes it very clear. And I think this would be really the experience of the Omaha Task Force, as Anna and I have experienced it also. People who engage in human trafficking don't believe that we as a community are interested in the least in doing anything about the modern form of slavery. In that report, they indicated that 21% of the pimps who were interviewed had switched from drug trafficking to human trafficking because the money was every bit as good in human trafficking, but there was no perceived risk in being a human trafficker, whereas they knew they were after them if they were a drug trafficker. We have to change that analysis. We have to make human traffickers know that we will come after them and that we will do so aggressively and with serious penalties. And so one of the things that the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force is absolutely dedicated to is being proactive, not waiting to be reactive to cases, but going out and finding traffickers, finding obviously victims and survivors, and finding the buyers, the so-called Johns, but the buyers, and going after all of those people to deal with them appropriately in the circumstances. That's a real short synopsis of a 70-page document, but that's the emphasis of what we are trying to do.
Thank you. We are going to open it up for questions, but just right before we do, I just want everybody on this panel to just give a call to action to the folks here today, and what is the one thing that you want the audience to know, just very briefly, and then we'll open it up for questions. And I'm going to start with part of the federal campaign is if you see something, say something. And so, you know, that I just want to leave with you that if you've taken away anything today, it's you've learned a little bit about what this might look like. So if you see something, say something.
Well, I will echo what Stephen has said about no buyers, no trafficking. But I also want to send the message that, and I spent much of my career trying to convince people that there is no consenting adult. People would say, well, she's a consenting adult engaging in consenting sex. She's an adult, Anna. Go look for the missing children. And I will argue and argue and argue that that adult had some vulnerability when she or he was a child that caused them to be in the situation that they're in as an adult. So if I can leave you with one message, I want to leave you with that it's not a consenting adult engaging in consenting sex. I promise you it's not.
I would echo what Anna said. I've with the Wellspring program, we work with people who identify as prostitutes and as survivors of trafficking. And the way that they are treated by society is just painful. So recognizing that we need to be non-judgmental about these groups of people, regardless of what they identify themselves as. They've been victimized in so many different ways. And as service providers especially, we're just adding to that trauma if we react to themselves selling themselves for sex or having somebody else sell them for sex. So
get involved. This isn't just for law enforcement and services and listed community providers. This will only ultimately be successful if the community gets involved, if people raise awareness about this issue, if people influence their legislators, if people influence the establishment that exists, whether it be the judiciary. Do you know what the fine used to be for recidivist Johns, buyers of sex? $99. Do you know why? Because at $100, you get your name in the paper. Who are we protecting? Probably not the victims. Probably not the survivors. So get involved. Influence the mayor's office, the chief of police, the sheriff's department, which, by the way, there's an excellent sheriff in Douglas County on this particular issue. He's one of the most involved people, and he's at the heart of what we're trying to do. Tim Dunning. So a little commercial for Tim there. Thank you, Tim. But get involved, and get involved on the other side too. Don't be a part of the problem. Don't be a buyer. Don't engage in pornography, and we could talk about that and show you the link there. Don't engage in abuse. So get involved.
I'd love to thank our panel, but if you could all please give them a hand, and I'm sure you could stand around and ask questions still. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a panel discussion on the topic Human Trafficking in the Heartland. The members of the panel were Stephen O'Mara, Assistant Attorney General and Human Trafficking Coordinator in the Nebraska State Attorney General's Office, Anna Brewer, former agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and currently training consultant for the Women's Fund of Omaha, and Alicia Weber, Human Trafficking Task Force Coordinator and Project Manager with the Salvation Army's Fight to End Trafficking, or SAFE-T program. The moderator was Megan Malik, Trafficking Response Coordinator with the Women's Fund of Omaha. The number again for the Human Trafficking Hotline is 888-3737-888. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday morning, March 22, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.